Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Teo Balve, author of The Frontier Effect, State Formation and Violence in Colombia, published this year by Cornell University Press. Dr. Balve, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Sure. Well, let's see. I was born in Argentina, but grew up mainly in the U.S. and different parts of Latin America. And so after college, I sort of fell into this journalism job that was focused on reporting in Latin America, specifically a magazine called NACLA out of New York. That was sort of a lefty magazine about Latin American politics. And I began working as a journalist and then started doing a lot of freelancing in different countries and ended up in Colombia in about 2006. And I moved to Colombia and started reporting on the drug war there. And during one of those reporting trips, I was in this part of Southwest Colombia where there was this meeting between indigenous people, indigenous groups, and Afro-Colombians. And they both started talking about how in the far northwest of the country, so this is up by Panama, this region called Urabá, there was these palm oil plantations that were being developed by right-wing paramilitary groups and their associated companies, and that these oil palm plantations were dispossessing these Afro-Colombian communities. And so very shortly after that trip, I organized a trip to this northwest part of Colombia, Urabá, and I started doing an investigative journalistic project on that, the dispossession of those communities. I was trying to find a link between oil palm companies, the violent paramilitary groups, and actually grant money from USAID, which was supporting different agricultural projects across the country. So I spent like a year investigating that story. And I was at the same time, I had gotten into investigative journalism, but at the same time, I was getting kind of sick of freelancing. And I'd always kept a foot in academia. And so I decided to go back to graduate school and went to a geography program at Berkeley to get a PhD. And that investigative project was essentially like the foundations for my dissertation project, which was very, and many years later turned into this book. So that's a bit of a long story short. There's more I could go into, but that's the nutshell.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll get into some of the other things as we go through some of the other questions that I've got for you here. So your subtitle of the book says State Formation and Violence, not State Formation or Violence, State Formation versus Violence, because one of the things that you do in your book is to challenge the idea that if there's violence, that means state formation has failed to occur or that state formation necessarily brings peace. So could you elaborate on that idea?
Sure. I mean, there is this very widely held view, not just among the sort of political science scholarly community, But also, I think in most conflict-ridden places, you know, where you're, whether you're talking about Colombia or you're talking about parts of Mexico, even, or the DRC, which is this assumption that wherever there is, you know, political violence, it's often because of a lack of a state presence. So it's this Hobbesian argument that, you know, wherever there's a vacuum of the state, you have that war of all against all. And what really surprised me when I started visiting this region of Colombia is how, and lots of regions of Colombia actually, is how prevalent that discourse is. I mean, no one's citing Hobbes, obviously, but you go to almost any one of these really, you know, hot spots of violence in Colombia that have been, you know, mired in conflict for decades and decades. And you ask almost anyone from any part of the political spectrum, like, you know, why has this place been so violent for all these years? And invariably, almost like, you know, without fail, they'll tell you, oh, well, it's the absence of the state. What I tried to set out in this book is at the same time, you know, take those claims seriously. Don't just dismiss them as like, you know, false consciousness or something like that. But really look into how this idea of absence is not necessarily a product that violence is a result of this absence, but rather that this whole idea of absence in a way lays the groundwork or creates the sorts of conditions and possibilities for all kinds of political projects to sort of flourish, and they're violently opposed to each other. And it's that kind of conflict and that interaction between those various different state projects, none of which really agree with each other 100%, that generates the sort of violence that I was seeing in this part of the country. So, I mean, whether you're talking about left-wing guerrillas, whether I'm talking about right-wing paramilitary groups, the security forces, unions, landowners, all these different groups that I saw sort of coming into conflict in these really complicated ways were sort of in the business of state formation in this kind of very violent process. So, yeah, I state formation, I think anywhere, at least, you know, in some ways is a violent process. But there's something about these parts of Colombia where everyone thinks the state is, you know, nowhere to be found, where you can almost see those sorts of struggles almost like in real time.
Yeah. So I want to kind of dig into that a little more and get into some of the specifics of these state formation processes that are going on. And, you know, we're on the Geography Channel. So I was particularly interested in your discussions of the formation of territory as part of these projects by, you know, all those different groups you named, the unions and the left-wing guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries and so forth. So could you talk a bit in particular about the territorial dimension to these rival state formation projects?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, maybe it would help a little bit just to give like a thumbnail sketch of like the groups here and a little bit of the background of the conflict. In the 1960s, you had this proliferation of left-wing communist-inspired guerrilla groups in different parts of Colombia. And then those groups were sort of a traditional Cold War story with counterinsurgency from the state and those left-wing groups, you know, fighting back, dirty war from the government. And then in the 1980s, the cocaine trade really took off. And that helped the guerrilla groups really finance their tremendous amount of growth. So they expanded to all different parts of the country. And those drug traffickers had been starting to buy rural land and laundering money in these, you know, very agrarian parts of the country. And those guerrilla groups started kidnapping the drug traffickers, just as they had done to the, you know, old school landowners before, and holding them kidnapped for ransom payments. And that's also how these guerrilla groups financed each other. And the response to that was this huge backlash where those old school landowners and the new, you know, landowning narco elite kind of joined forces and created these right wing paramilitary groups that teamed up with the military to fight back the guerrillas and ended up, you know, slaughtering hundreds, thousands of civilians, you know, accusing them of harboring guerrilla sympathies. So that's kind of like the broad sketch here. And the reason that that story is important is because in what I call these frontier regions of Colombia, you have all those different groups. There are, you know, a handful of different guerrilla groups. There are the right-wing paramilitaries. You have the narco traffickers. You have the landowners. You have the state security forces, sort of civilian government actors, international aid groups. And what happens in these spaces is that, especially from the armed groups, they start vying for control over this, in this case, a very strategic region of the country. And to control those areas, they create these territories. In other words, these spaces in which they say pretty much like, you know, what happens here is what I say goes within this particular given space. And what ends up happening is that you get this sort of proliferation of territories. And you can imagine these like different territories almost like sloshing around in a cauldron. And they kind of come together and they collide, and wherever they overlap, there's these very violent conflicts to gain control. And when one group takes over another group's territory, the civilian communities that lived in that space are then being, you know, overrun and persecuted by the new, boss in town. But rather than, and this is the sort of geographical thing, rather than seeing these territories as just these, you know, patches of land demarcated here, there, and everywhere, what I really try to show in the book is the way in which these territories are formed as a series of social relationships. So those social relationships involve, one of the relationships I really focus on is the relationship between a given armed group, say the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, one of the leftist groups, and civilian communities, or the right-wing paramilitaries and the peasant communities that end up, you know, inhabiting those territories. Because it's not just like a group can show up and say, you know, this land is my land now. They have to, I describe it as a process of both coercion and consent. So they have to show up and they have to really, you know, smash out the competing group and the sort of social networks of support. So that involves oftentimes like massacres or displacing the civilian population. But then there comes a time where it can't be all coercion all the time. If you want to keep control of the space, you also have to kind of cultivate consent among the population. So it's this sort of choreography between coercion and consent that these armed groups have to engage in with these civilian communities. And that involves, you know, all kinds of things. I saw armed groups doing little land reforms, or, you know, building schools and bridges, or brokering relationships with the municipal government. All kinds of things. And it's in the relationship, in that social relationship of territory, that these state formations, as I call them in the plural, kind of bubble out of those processes. Not always in intentional ways, but in some cases in very conscious ways.
All right. So let's talk now a bit about your specific study area, because you were focusing mm-hmm. on this region of Urabá that is in the far northwestern kind of part of the country near Panama. So, mm-hmm. you know, you describe it as a frontier zone. So could you talk a bit about, you know, in what sense is this a frontier zone, and why does that matter for mm-hmm. What you're saying about the conflict in this mm-hmm. region?
Yeah, so this is, it's, as you said, northwest region of the country. It's called Urawa. It's not like an administrative unit or district in any sense. So you can think of it almost like in that kind of amorphous way that we think of like Appalachia or the outback in Australia. It straddles a few different, three different departments or states, provinces, departments they're called in Colombia. And it's kind of lowland, tropical region. There are some more mountainous areas. And historically, since the 1960s at least, it's been a banana export enclave. And the importance of it being a frontier is that, like all frontiers, it's a kind of an imaginary geographical formation. And so even during colonial times, Urawa, or Darien as it was called back then, was seen as this kind of savage no man's land. And then around around 1900, Colombia, through some engineering from the US government, loses Panama. Panama used to be a province of Colombia, and the U.S. helps Panama secede essentially from Colombia. And Urawa is right next to Panama. And so you had a lot of Colombian elites at the time worrying that that Urawa would be next, and that there's this, you know, this patch of land, Urawa, that's unruly, it's ungoverned. We have to kind of bring it into the fold of the nation and bring it under our control. And those arguments were coming most strongly from urban elites based in Medellin. And Medellin is one of Colombia's largest cities. And for a long time, it's been this industrial, commercial, financial kind of powerhouse in the country. And the reason Urawa was important to those elites is because Medellin is in the middle of the mountains, and it's part of this province called Antioquia, and it's landlocked, or it was back then. And so those elites saw Urawa as this, as they called it, their outlet to the sea. So if Medellin was to prosper, they would need to bring this unruly, ungoverned region under their control. And you begin seeing a lot of these discourses about, you know, bringing, I mean, back then they were talking, the tropes were about, you know, civilization and barbarism. Had this whole like very racist, and to us in the United States, a very familiar kind of frontier discourse. And they even talked about manifest destiny. So it was very much on the model of the US, you know, relationship to the Western frontier. And the frontier in that same sense was as much a sort of conjuring of the imagination of the space as it was a material process. So if in the U.S. West, it was the railroad that kind of consummated that whole relationship, in Urawa, it was a road. And these elites in Medellin and the government, the state government of Antioquia, wanted to build a road into the region to make it their agricultural sort of, at the time they were hoping to turn it into cotton because Medellin had textile mills, but it ended up turning into this banana enclave sponsored by the US-based United Fruit Company. And whether it was in the making of that road or is it in the making of the export enclave, both those processes involved the mass dispossession of local Afro-Colombian and indigenous communities who were being, you know, again, exploited in this very colonial kind of way. I call it internal colonialism. So it was this racialized making of this frontier. And as a geographer, I was very interested in the way that was both a work of the imagination, but also a kind of political, economic, very material sort of process. So I talk a lot about the construction of the road and the way in which surplus capital from Medellin was like, you know, spurting into the region, being shunted into the agricultural projects as well, in a process we call uneven development. And Well, like I said, throughout that entire process, it was sort of built on this whole idea of this, you know, savage land that needed to come under the sway of the predominantly white, rich, urban elites from Medellin, who are also very conservative, religious. I mean, you can think of Antioquia as almost like the Texas of Colombia. It's like, it's about, you know, manly, chauvinist, deeply religious, conservative, cattle culture in that same sort of frontier sort of way. And those were the elites that were, you know, descending on this region and throwing everyone off their land to implement these political economic projects.
Okay. So changing gears a little bit here, in your little bio sketch back at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned that you had been a journalist doing research and writing about this conflict before you became an academic working on the same topic area. So could you tell us about what were some of the differences that you found in both the research process and the writing process between looking at this conflict as a journalist and then looking at it as an academic?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something I think I struggled with a lot, both methodologically and in writing. Well, I don't know, struggle is really the right word, but I thought a lot about the sort of interplay between the two. I think as a journalist, especially when I first arrived to this region, I made a series of mistakes about, you know, accessing some parts of this region is really hard. And so like I would contact these NGOs that would help me, gain access essentially to certain kinds of communities that I otherwise wouldn't have access to. But associating so closely with those NGOs, which was sort of like what I had to do to get the story, made it really hard to talk to other groups in the region. So that door opened, but the doors to, say, those communities like sworn enemies were immediately shut off. And so when I started developing this project, I was really careful to basically, the strategy I came up with was talk to everybody. So I would talk to paramilitaries, I would talk to the guerrillas, the landowners, the union activists, the displaced peasants, the government people, basically trying to show myself as not being of any one particular group. And so it wouldn't be weird if I was talking to a guerrilla one day, and then the next day he sees me talking to like his sworn enemies, you know, in some other community. And then a lot of the journalistic methods that I use to research land grabbing, you know, going to public records research, going to chambers of commerce and like collecting this huge archive of like bureaucratic documents and notaries offices, and you know, triangulating within those documents, but also triangulating with what people were telling me, was a really useful thing to do. And I think that you know, ability to track down and work with documents was something that I got from the investigative journalism that I was doing. And then in terms of writing, you know, I wanted to tell a story. I mean, narrative is really important to me. And in some ways, it's kind of a burden because I wish I just didn't care and could write like some really dry, you know, just the facts, ma'am, sort of story. But I do my best to make my writing readable and engaging, and develop characters and that kind of thing. Not out of, you know, I'm not making it up, but I do try to think of it in that sort of creative nonfiction kind of way. So that was both, you know, an aspiration and a bit of a curse, because it made me take forever to write it.
Well, I will say that the writing in this book is very engaging and readable. You definitely
Thank you.
Did not fall into the dry academic tome kind of writing style that we see
sometimes. Glad to hear it. Glad to hear it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, so I want to follow up a bit on, you know, you were talking about how you were able to talk to all the different sides of the conflict. And one of the things that I found really interesting about the book is that not just that you're talking to people that are on different sides of this conflict, but you're talking sometimes to some pretty big figures on the various sides of this conflict. And in particular, one of the sort of major personalities that runs through a lot of the book is this paramilitary leader that's called El Alemán, the German. And it was just kind of impressive that you got this access to him and were able to interview him about his role in the conflict and you know, his perspective on things. So could you talk maybe a bit more about that individual and, you know, what, you know, kind of how you got to be able to actually talk to him, and then what that brought to your research?
Sure. Yeah, so El Alemán, whose name is Freddy Rendón, he showed up to Urabá in when he was like probably in his late teens, early 20s. I can't remember exactly when. But he was a truck driver. That was like his first job, was essentially being like a truck driver's assistant, sitting, you know, shotgun. And then he started driving his own trucks. And, you know, it was like he would take beer to the region or whatever it was, and often came back to Medellin. He would go from Medellin to Urabá, deliver the stuff, and then bring back a bunch of contraband. So he started off as a truck driver. And as a truck driver driving through the roads of Colombia in, you know, the 80s, you were being constantly harassed and stopped by guerrillas. You would have to pay like what they would call tolls, and those kinds of things. And so he took a pretty strong dislike to the guerrillas, not only because of that, but also because his family as a child had been thrown off their land by the FARC, by the guerrillas. And he shows up to Urabá in the mid-90s, and he meets one of the founders of Colombian paramilitary groups. His name is Carlos Castaño. And he's just like, his jaw drops when he hears this guy talking. And he was this very charismatic ideologue of the paramilitary movement. And El Alemán's like, you know, well, I'm just going to join up with these guys. I really don't have a whole lot more to, you know, better to do. And so he joins in the mid-90s and very quickly, you know, climbs the ranks of the paramilitary group to the point where Carlos Castaño's like, hey, you need your own paramilitary group. Like, you know, they're divided into blocks. And so Carlos Castaño was like, why don't you run, you know, these parts of Urabá with this new paramilitary group? Which ended up being called the Bloque Elmer Cárdenas, or just the BEC or the BEC. And so El Alemán became the BEC's commander, and he was probably the savviest counterinsurgent paramilitary commander that I can think of. I mean, there might be a couple others, but he's certainly up there, so much so that Carlos Castaño would send El Alemán and his group to different parts of Colombia when they were kind of opening new fronts in the war. So they were like, hey, Alemán, we're going to start this, you know, campaign against the guerrillas in the Amazon, like go there and like be the spearhead essentially of our counterinsurgency campaign there. So he was this really powerful paramilitary commander, and he was also like incredibly and remains incredibly charismatic. And so despite the fact that his group was this murderous, you know, killed thousands and thousands of people in some of the most gruesome ways that we've heard in Colombian contemporary conflict, through, you know, thousands of people off their land, he managed to build this huge base of popular support in Urabá. And going back to your question about as a journalist, you know, when I was a journalist, I would see that, and I saw his supporters protesting outside of his trial. So when he went to trial, his supporters were out there in front of the courthouse, like, you know, demonstrating in support. And I remember being like, oh, what a bunch of bullshit. Like, that's just, you know, that's all smoke and mirrors. It's just for show. But then through like long-term fieldwork, I began learning so much more about the relationship that he managed to cultivate with so many communities. And he has this very sophisticated narrative or discourse about the conflict, about his own personal experiences, about how, you know, he's fighting for the communities. It's not the story you usually hear about right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia. Just like in Colombia, all the armed groups, they've all done terrible things. I'm not a supporter of the FARC or the ELN or any of the other guerrilla groups, but the right-wing paramilitaries really are, you know, some of the most brutal of all the armed groups that have been involved in the conflict. They've done these huge massacres, and so they're often like the bad guys of the story, especially in academia, because they're, you know, right wing counterinsurgency. They're really like supporting the political economic elites of the country, you know, some pretty shady, unsavory characters. And what was really interesting to me about El Alemán and his paramilitary bloc specifically was that ability to build these relationships with civilian communities.
Okay. And then again, changing gears a little bit here, the main kind of capital T theorist that you engage with in this book is Henri Lefebvre. And so I'm interested in how you kind of learned about Lefebvre and came to see his work as useful in explaining what's going on in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. So I at Berkeley Geography, where I did my PhD, there was, I mean, I think like in a lot of grad schools, especially at that moment, you know, I think Foucault, Gramsci, and Lefebvre were sort of major touchstones of critical geography. And Lefebvre, and in so many ways to me, still to this day, is like so impenetrable. I mean, it's really hard sometimes to follow the things that he's saying, but I was really struck by this whole idea of the production of space, the way in which, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the frontier, the way in which space is this is a series of social relationships that are both, you know, ideological, mental, discursive, but also concrete, physical, material. And then third, that there's spaces that we live, and that space is something that we live and experience. And all three dimensions of space, if you will, are essential to it. And the things that I was seeing in Urabá about the way this, you know, region was portrayed and projected and produced as a frontier zone, really jived with what the production of space is all about in my mind. Territory too. I read a piece by Stuart Eldon and Neil Brenner about the production of territory. So they were applying Lefebvre's framework to territory, and that just made a lot of sense. You know, I could see how say, for instance, in the case of the paramilitaries, how, you know, the violence that they were waging to control an area, the agricultural plantations, the agribusiness plantations that they were introducing, the people they were killing and displacing, the kind of like rhetoric and discourse they would use. I mean, I could see in every case how this whole very sophisticated understanding of space as a social product made a lot of sense in explaining the kinds of things that I was looking at. So for me, he was just a way to take this sort of fetishized, commonsensical thing that we don't even really think about or consider, aka space, and really show how formative it is to social relations, to society and our politics and economics. I mean, all up and down. It just made a lot of sense to me. And I guess that's kind of how I came to it. And it just, I don't know, it just, it clicked because of that production of space that made so much sense to me, whether I was thinking about the frontier, about territory, or about like community too. So take, you know, any kind of spatial constructs, and it's a powerful tool, I think, in like picking apart a series of relationships and finding the most, you know, the most powerful or formative ones.
Okay, well, now that we've given our listeners a good idea of what this book holds in store for them, we always like to end our interviews by asking what you're working on next. What kind of projects are you taking up now that this book is out?
Yeah, this is one of those, and now for something completely different kind of moments. I work at Colgate University. I'm in peace and conflict studies and geography here, and Colgate is in central New York. So like that's like 4 hours northwest from New York City. It's like a middle of nowhere, very rural area, about 45 minutes outside of Syracuse. And I teach a class on environmental security. It's like this very critical approach to environmental security. It's essentially like a political ecology of violence class. But I thought at one point it would be cool to have like a local prepper come and speak to the class. And I met this guy here who lives in the area. And I started, I wanted him to come and talk to my class about like preppers and, you know, environmental disasters and that sort of thing. I just thought it'd be cool to have like a completely different perspective on some of the issues that we were talking about. And he's come to my class now, I don't know, like almost every year I've taught the class, and just kind of struck up a relationship with him. And he very nicely like invited me to join his prepper group. And so I started going to their monthly meetings and essentially started doing like participant observation, you know, prepping. So I've accumulated a good amount of preps in my basement, as they're called. And have still been going to those meetings. And while doing this, I started, the different people in the preppers group would make these sort of passing comments about how like, oh, this weekend we're going to go to this like, you know, trading, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, well, is that like another prepper group? And they were like, oh, yeah, like sort of a prepper group. Well, it turns out that they are in these different, what they would call, I think, patriot groups. So the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, militias, some would call them. And I got interested in that whole relationship between prepping and armed right-wing politics here in rural America. And so I started working on that issue, and then, you know, January 6th happened, and it was all the groups that I had started to read about the year before. And so that's, I don't know exactly what the research question is or whatnot, but that's the direction that I'm that I'm going in now. It's really kind of sucked me in. So I find it really, really interesting. And it's not so far-fetched to see the connections with my work in Colombia, in the sense that, both in some ways kind of deal with grassroots armed movements and right-wing politics and rural political economy, so agrarian political economy. I don't know. I do see the parallels, but it is, refreshingly different. I haven't left Colombia completely behind, but the sort of stuff that I was like sort of looking into wasn't getting me as excited as this, local project that I have going here. So for at least like the near term, that's what I'm going to be, looking into.
Okay. Well, shout out to Colgate University, since that's my alma mater, the class of 02. Totally. So I think a little bit before you got there, but that project sounds fascinating. And if you end up turning that into the book, maybe you'll come back on the show and talk about that.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to. Many, many years from now, probably, unfortunately. But yeah, that'd be great. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on the show. So you just heard a conversation with Teo Balve, author of The Frontier Effect, State Formation and Violence in Colombia, published this year by Cornell University Press.